This morning, the main theme will be on envy. And just before we begin envy, it was something I read years and years ago when I was young and keen on reading translations, and that was some of Dante's poetic work, not in the original, of course, translation. It was once called by one poet, envy, a coal that comes hissing from hell. But the best description is by Dante, and this is interesting information. In the second part of his Divine Comedy, titled Purgatory, which follows on from the more better known part, which is the Inferno, hell, being cast into hell, there's a purgatory section in which Dante, accompanied by the Roman poet, the great poet Virgil, is on a climb of the Mount of Purgatory. Now, the Mount of Purgatory has 9 levels, and it's all linked to the deadly sins, the 7 deadly sins, but there's 2 added. And each one teaches Dante a lesson about life in his journey on the way to meet God. And the levels, because they are interesting, because they are all problems, and this is where the relevance comes in. There were problems to Joseph's brothers, and also for us today. Stubbornness, repentant, pride, envy, wrath, laziness, sloth, avarice, greed, gluttony, lust. And on the envy terrace, the envious, the people who have been put there because they've been too envious in life, the envious penitents wander about or sit by a wall. Their eyelids are actually sewn shut with iron wire, so they can't see. This symbolism is actually very apt. Envy is one of the blindest sins, you see. You don't notice it because it's very unreasonable. Particularly as the sufferer of envy, real envy, nasty envy, is wrapped up in himself or herself and can't get out, and full of nasty, horrible thoughts. They are in a world, therefore, of dark anguish. And that's the Dante section. Now, Shakespeare actually calls in one of his plays, I can't remember which, he calls it the green sickness, green with envy. The superb story of Joseph is a masterpiece of narration. It forms a coherent and continuous narrative right the way through the story. It's a highly moral tale of the innocent victim of envy, jealousy, and downright ill will, who finally turns the tables, does he not, on his persecutors by succeeding despite their nastiness, and he turns good for the evil. Joseph was actually fixed in my memory banks for many, many years. I can remember in the East Coast floods, if you recall these, the great North Sea East Coast floods. That's the one Noah came out a lot. I've actually seen Noah, yes, on the floods, looking out across Breydon Water. He floated past. In 1952/3 winter, we received, as a result, we were all washed out and nothing left, like, you know. We received Canadian flood aid at the time, food and clothes, and my gift actually was, and I still remember it, a highly coloured lumberjack jacket with its many brightly coloured woven reds and browns and whites and things like this. And I had to wear this coat of many colours, and wherever I went, the noisome youths of Cobham, who were very noisome, believe you me, and lively, would bawl out, "Joseph! Joseph! Here comes Joseph!" And of course, as a callow youth of 12-year-old, I got very upset about it and ran. And they gave up other ruder pleasantries as well, you know, in the passing. And of course, that's why I've been introverted and shy, good people, ever since, because of that. Now, the story, this is important, the story, to quote from von Rad's commentary, has a, and I quote, a wonderful openness to what is human, us. Hate, envy, passion, guilt, paternal anxiety, yes, love, lust, honour, chivalry, all churning up that narrow circle of one family in labyrinthian entanglement. Wonderful sentence. Time constraints allow us, apart from that list, we can only pick one this morning. So let's go to it. But every one of them has a living message for us today, which is the amazing thing about the scriptures. Now Joseph, at the age of 17, nice lad, did nothing wrong as far as I can see, was shocked, honestly shocked in my view, at the behaviour of his brothers. It's not specified in what manner the behaviour exemplified itself, but they were, if you recall, very lively young men. And lively men together can get up to lively things. And about being a dutiful son and an honest one, Joseph reported their behaviour to his dad, Jacob. You can imagine the brother's reaction on being shocked to Peter, can't you? It wouldn't have been very good, because you see, sadly in this case, Joseph lacked guile in the matter. And by the way, an aptitude which would bring his downfall now, but later on would serve him good when he lived in Egypt. Now, Father Jacob actually compounded the sibling rivalry, which Rabbi spoke about a short while ago, by showing excessive favoritism to Joseph, son of his preferred wife, Rachel. And he made him, I don't understand why, having worn one, he made him, as the KJV puts it, a coat of many colours, which is obviously rather pleased. It really implies, I think, a sort of ceremonial robe with all its ornaments overall. And therefore, it singled out Jacob, just like my coat of many colours singled me out in common all those years ago. And he probably got the same sort of responses at the time, and more. As Genesis 37:4 says, the brothers hated Joseph and could not speak peaceably to him. They weren't peaceable. They were shirty and nasty, I would imagine. Again, you can imagine the turmoil in the family. Continuing, we note that Joseph then has a couple of dreams. And of course, in those dreams, the brothers did not take kindly to being told that they, as sheaves of corn, would bow down to Joseph, and certainly not as stars bowing down in the heavens. And again, one has to ask, hey, Joseph, were you real about this? Are you so innocent and guileless to actually tell your dreams? And were you amazed, were you surprised when your brothers didn't exactly share your wondrous delight at the stories? Amazing. Verse 11 says, and his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the sayings in mind. Probably the father was, because he was a favourite, Joseph, probably the father was not too averse at its fulfillment. Now, one day, Joseph's brothers went to pasture their flocks, father's flocks, near Shechem. Evidently, everything in Shechem had quieted down there, because as you know, as readers of the scriptures, avid readers of the scriptures, you will know that in chapter 4, the Dinah episode was recorded. But everything had quietened down. Even so, Jacob sent Joseph to check his brothers out, to see if they were all right. He probably knew they were a lively gang who could end up having rows and stuff. An unnamed man, I always find that interesting, how many unnamed people have a key part in the scriptures, you know? An unnamed man redirected him to Dathan. Dathan. Great people's lives, I think, are full of unnamed people without whose interest the great would never achieve their greatness. And he directed him. If he hadn't been there, there would have been no direction. Interesting. Seeing him from afar off, the brothers conspired to kill him, muttering, and probably more than mutter, here comes that dreamer, dozy dreamer, whatever. Come on, now, let's do away with him and throw him into one of the pits, one of the cisterns. Brotherly love, envy, pure envy. Fortunately, Reuben was less pitiless, and they agreed at his urging to simply throw him into the cistern alive. I wasn't going to kill him, he was going to be thrown in alive. This was done after bagging his coat of many colours. Now, not a little pit, these pits, this one was dry, and it was shaped like a bottle and very narrow at the top. So if you were slung in or fell in, you can't get out again without outside help. So think of Reuben's mercy, if you will. Joseph would have had quite a tumble, you know. I imagine he would have could have broken something, although the scripture doesn't say so. It would have been quite a fall. And of course, another point, he couldn't get out, and they didn't throw any water down with him, did they? Another interesting thought that I had, no water. I have to say that Reuben obviously meant to sneak back somehow and get his brother out. And then it says, and this is where Nathan comes in, verse 25 says, then they sat down to eat. They sat down to eat after slinging their brother down a cistern. They sat down, all sat down to have lunch. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I don't know how they could ignore his predicament so calmly. That's envy at its worst. And I'm going to ask Nathan to read from chapter 37, 25 to 36. And I like various versions of the Bible. I like, in this case, not my old King James, I do like the RSV translation. I think it's rather good on this super story. From the selling of a hated brother to the Midianites, on to Egypt and the Potiphar episode. Nathan, you can hold that. Shall I tap it for you?
Look. Yeah. Can you hold it for me? That'd be great.
Don't put it off your nose.
No. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh. On their way to carry it down to Egypt, then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And the brothers heeded him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him up out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, He rent his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe, killed a goat, and dipped the robe in its blood. And they sent the long robe with sleeves and brought it to their father and said, This we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." And he recognized it and said, "It's my son's robe. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob rent his garments and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard.
Thank you very much, Nathan. Very good, good. And the other thing is, of course, do you see how envy can lead on to total family dismemberment? It's an evil business, envy. 20 shekels. He got 20 shekels of silver. Apparently, I looked it up, and that's only 2/3 of the value of an ordinary slave. So those brothers weren't after money. Money wasn't the main game. Killing their brother was. I wonder if Jacob, you know, another thought I had, did Jacob know the real truth on being shown that blood-stained coat of many colours? Did he know the real truth? His declaration, for instance, that a wild beast had killed him was very sudden and off the cuff. There had been no investigation at all. No doubt, because he loved the son so much, he was frightened to know the actual truth and didn't pursue it. And in fact, a little bit later on, in 42, verse 36, he charged the brothers, did he not, and said, "You have," and this is the key point which made me think, "you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more." An odd statement, isn't it? Makes you think. What dark thoughts must have, and dismal thoughts must have, crossed the father's mind all the while. But why didn't he accuse them? I don't know. Perhaps a further breach of family quarrelling would lead to more envious hatred. Who knows? So what am I saying? Envy and jealousy, and you can mix them, envy and jealousy are wicked twins. Twins. And here's the point. All of us, there isn't a person in this room who hasn't experienced the twins at some time or other. Fortunately, most of us get over the green sickness pretty quickly without any real consequences. Some are not so lucky, and you only have to listen to the media on television, in the papers or online, to know that the green sickness stalks the world. Of the two, and this is my thought on it, I think envy is the more serious sickness. Envy. Envy is a painful awareness of an advantage enjoyed by another person. Someone has something. They're enjoying it. We aren't. It wants that someone else actually possesses. It mourns or is envious because he or she hasn't got it. It wants what it hasn't got. To my mind, that's envy. Jealousy is subtly different. It already has something, but feels threatened by the invasion of others onto that precious territory. It's like when I played hockey in varsity university, and had a brilliant little forward, that's why we called him Tom Thumb. Anyhow, Tommy, brilliant. I was good at scoring goals and knew it, and it showed. I liked scoring goals at hockey, as centre half. And although it was good for the team, every time he scored a goal, I was jealous. That's jealousy. He was pinching my area, my thunder. So it would be a reluctant. We didn't kiss each other in those days and do dives. You just give him a pat on the shoulder. So mine was a slow pat on the back. And I'm a bit ashamed about it now, because it ruined unity of the team, you see. And you can even, soccer players, do they not end up not passing to each other in big games, you know? So there we are. There is a fear of losing of what I have to someone else. Now here's a bit for you Shakespeareans. I'm sure you're all Shakespeareans. Do you like reading Shakespeare? Othello was one of my favourites. There's that wonderful outburst, isn't there? When Othello fears he's losing his love, his Desdemona. You've all got it. Yes, that's it. He's afraid of losing Desdemona. And he says, I had rather be a toad and live upon the vapour of a dungeon than keep a corner apart of the thing I love for others' uses. Very wonderful, that, this good expression. The green sickness. Song of Solomon, chapter 8. Jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire. Or Proverbs 6:34. Jealousy enrages a man. A favourite read of mine, and I'm not going to mention the great Oswald Chambers, but another favourite of mine a bit later on is Charles Swindle. And he puts envy, jealousy, just listen to this. This is really raw statement about envy, jealousy. It's really raw, this. He reckons that envy, jealousy is like an anger-blind, half-starved rat prowling in the foul-smelling sewers below street level. So is the person caged within the suffocating radius of selfish jealousy, trapped by resentment and diseased by rage. He feeds on the filth of his imagination. Wow, that's strong stuff, isn't it? That's putting it at the extreme. That's envy. That's why it's a sin, a deadly sin. He goes on to list the damage this parasite causes. And we all know examples, as I'm sure. It will decimate a friendship, dissolve a romance, and destroy a marriage. It will shoot tension through the ranks of professionals. It will nullify unity on a team. It will ruin a congregation. And indeed, as we witnessed some years ago, a government. With squint eyes, jealousy will question motives and deplore another's success. Jealousy. It will become severe, suspicious, narrow, and negative. Swindle writes that by the grace of Yeshua, he crawled out of the sewer, and the releasing sunlight of freedom captured his heart. The difference that it made to relationship was utter delight, in his opinion. So Joseph was the victim of blatant injustice, both when his brothers sold him into slavery and when in Egypt Potiphar's wife accused him falsely of rape. Yet this man did not indulge in self-righteousness or self-pity, neither did he plan revenge. But instead, as you recall, he generously forgave his brothers. He also made the best of every situation he was in, like during his long imprisonment, when he put his ability to interpret those dreams to good use. Joseph was sustained by God's protection. And when the tide turned, when it turned, he never doubted, when he got to the good times, this man never doubted that the Lord lay behind his success. That was his secret. The Lord behind the success. And his story, I think, is a witness to God being able to transform evil situations. And of course, that transformation, is it not summed up later on in the next parashat to his brothers, when he said to his brothers, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." So Joseph was not just a man of God, but one who blended that word integrity with opportunity. And I think the Rabbi Hillel put it well, did he not? "If I am not for myself, who is for me? But if I am only for myself, if I am only for myself, what am I? Nothing." God can guide us and bless us. And sometimes he does so through our own efforts. It's up to us to make the most of our opportunities, and then God will guide as the opportunities arise. So finally, I suppose the answer is to be content within the Lord's daily grace. Because, you know, you and I, we are who we are and not others and not other people. No use putting ourselves in their shoes and being jealous and envious. We don't have to be better, go further, obtain more things, or be the cock sparrow, the tops. We do the best we can with what we've been given. Take our opportunities with what we've been given, and let the rest rest in God's peace, contentment. Because at the finality, and I would say this as someone you said at the beginning, "Rabbi, I am old and I'm having a go at talking," you realise more and more, month by month, year by year, we can't take houses, wealth, cups, awards, qualifications, etc., etc., with us on that final journey. Only ourselves, and this is most important, our track record. And I'd rather have Joseph's track record, guileless or no, than some of his brothers'.